In addition to the easy convenience of bathing two children together or three children together, there are other motivations of bathing them together. Parents are less aware of that. There is an excitement in seeing the children naked. And so the other things go into the decision, although convenience is what's stated first, I think other things do go into it. And you make an important point that through development, reactions to the genital difference and nudity will change. And I believe that those being aware of those changes is very useful for parents to make decisions about what they want to do in their family about family nudity, toileting, bathing, running around naked.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Eileen Lefcourt. Eileen shares with us a recent book of hers entitled Mothers and Daughters, The First 3 Years. And if you can only imagine how central the first 3 years are of any infant toddler's life, but certainly focusing on daughters and their mothers really brings a sharp attention to the many gender issues that arise between mothers and daughters in these key years. And we discuss many of them. And her work is based on her decades of work with groups of mothers. She has, in fact, had established the Sackler-Lefcourt Center for Child Development in 1982. She was the director, led the mother-baby-toddler groups, and provided developmental consultation for parents for over 35 years. She's taught child psychiatry residents, and she's a faculty member at the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. She has published widely. This is our second conversation. And in our speaking with each other, many themes, some known, some obvious, some far more obscure, come to the surface. For example, the famous movie Gigi. Thank heaven for little girls. We all know that phrase, thank heaven for little girls. What we don't know is the sentence that comes after it. Thank heaven for little girls, so helpless and appealing. Without them, what would little boys do? Changes a whole understanding of that period of time and the cultural pressures that families were under and girls felt they had to live up to. And Eileen points out how those themes are not just cultural, they're also internal, each impacting the other. She makes the case, as she has throughout all her work, that our own internal experiences as children live on in us and impacts how we view our own children. And the more aware we are of what's inside us, the more discerning we can be about how we bring that forward or choose not to bring that forward in raising our own children. We discuss some very commonplace concerns of parents, things as simple as the pink-blue choice for boys and girls, what it means for your daughter to want to be a girly girl or to not want to be a girly girl, what that means to each party, and how that dovetails with one's own, the parents, the mother's own experience of having been a girly girl or not been a girly girl herself growing up. But we also have a lovely exchange when a three-year-old gets dressed up to go somewhere and she says, "Do I look pretty?" And we unpack the meaning of "do I look pretty" from "am I pretty?" Each having very different meanings to the child, only if one listens, however. There's much more in it. We talk about the whining experience, self-stimulation, nudity in families. Eileen really covers the waterfront with this, and this would be of interest to certainly any parent of a daughter. It also applies to parents of sons, but more indirectly. I hope you enjoy it as I did. Here's my conversation with Eileen Lefcourt. Eileen, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you back on board again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Clinicians of adult individuals have a number of accesses to patients' inner lives, their childhood experiences. The first and most obvious is when we take a history and the patient relates to us their manifest memories, what they recall happened and didn't happen, and how they felt about it. This is, of course, a vital piece of the encounter with a new person. And it's also the series of memories that are most likely to evolve over the course of a deepening treatment. Memories change. As one's need to remember a certain way evolves, so does the memory evolve. Another source is we discover in the transference relationship. That is, how the person unknowingly, syntonically, lives out their past in the way they relate to the analyst. This is a more nuanced approach and access to memories that are often implicit, but contribute a vital weight to their current difficulties. And then there are memories that are sort of in the sort of video memories. That is, if we had video cameras of our early childhoods, and sometimes we do, of course, that would add a sort of a different approach to how we understand our pasts. And for that type of work, we turn to you because you have been working literally for decades with very young children and their families and observing how they interact, helping them process how they interact, and impacting how they interact, which undoubtedly has large amounts of influence in their adult life. Which brings us to your latest book, which, as I mentioned, is called Mothers and Daughters, The First 3 Years. And this book focuses exclusively on mothers and daughters from 0 to 3. And much happens between mothers and daughters from 0 to 3, as we were about to discover. And all mothers of daughters will be able to smile at various points that we're going to discuss and maybe chagrin at other points. And we would welcome their input over what you are about to share with them. And let me start off. We're going to read sequentially to work our way through many of the themes of the book. On literally page 1, you begin the introduction by saying, "The moment a woman hears it's a girl, her ideas about what being a girl means are set in motion. During the first 3 years of her daughter's life, a mother's own childhood experiences are reawakened and new ideas crystallize. She contemplates some ideas explicitly, while others occupy her mind subliminally, with the potential to emerge into conscious awareness. A mother's own activated childhood memories that mingle with current cultural themes contribute to her aspirations for her daughter." Let me read that last sentence again because it's so rich. "A mother's own activated childhood memories that mingle with current cultural themes contribute to her aspirations for her daughter." Eileen, the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, I thank you for inviting me to speak with you again. My work with parents and babies and toddlers and the books I've written focus on parents' childhood memories, but also their impact and how they are activated in interaction with their babies and toddlers. what Selma Freiberg called ghosts in the nursery. With Mothers and Daughters, unlike the other books, the enmeshment of personal and cultural themes in both memories and interactions is striking. For example, historically, when girls did not have the opportunities that they have today, and women could not achieve what they do today, being a good girl, which included obediently complying with prescribed gender roles, may have been overvalued. Today, in contrast, a girl developing a loud, clear voice, knowing what she thinks, how she feels, and believing that she is able to attain what she wants, are clearly valued. A girl's first relationships create the foundation for achieving these goals. However, typical mother-daughter conflicts during the first 3 years, which continue for life, can clash with mother's goals for their daughters. In many moments with her baby and toddler, having a loud voice and getting what she wants are not the mother's goals for her daughter.
You immediately on page two bring forward a really remarkable cultural event, and that is the movie Gigi. Now, when you say that, I think I am not alone in having it brought to mind as a sweet movie, a darling movie. And when I read this paragraph, I was so startled. So why don't you read this for us and share what it was like for you when you encountered this?
As I began to write about my work with mothers and their little girls, the 1958 movie Gigi came to mind. The movie illustrates that many things have changed for women and little girls, but many old ideas, though concealed and transformed on the surface, remain. When I was a little girl, the opening scene in 1900 Paris painted a vivid picture of a girl's value. I was enchanted, but now realize that the surface pretty picture concealed a disturbing subtext. While little girls frolicked with abandon, the song, "Thank Heaven for Little Girls," seemed adoring, as might be imagined from the title. In sharp contrast, the next words of the song are devaluing, but went unnoticed and unremembered. Thank heaven for little girls, so helpless and appealing. Without them, what would little boys do? Today, what jumps out about these words is the idea that little girls appearing helpless are appealing, and that their purpose and value is the pleasure that they provide for boys. For many girls without awareness, these diminishing words were absorbed as a prescription. For some women, the unacknowledged words were part of their belittled identity that they wanted to shed. Yet, Gigi won 9 Oscars and in 1991 was selected by the Library of Congress to be preserved in the United States National Film Registry. Many of the ideas about being a girl that are dramatized in the movie have also been preserved in our cultural unconscious and passed from one generation to the next. Ideas that mothers reject intellectually can remain emotionally active and be communicated to their daughters. For example, objectionable behavior may still be dismissed as boys will be boys. Or girls are told, he teases you because he likes you.
And one of the themes that run throughout your book is helping mothers become aware of multiple feelings they have that are in conflict with each other, i.e. wanting girls to be assertive and aggressive and speak their mind, and B, wanting girls to be soft and appealing and helpless. And how the mothers negotiated that in their lives, and how they are or are not of assistance in helping their daughters negotiate that in their lives is something we see in our offices and you've certainly seen in your work with your clientele.
And another point, Harvey, is that having a daughter can help a mother, a woman, see things about herself that she didn't see or wasn't aware of through her daughter. So, for example, when a little girl was walking in the park and saw a basketball court with her mother, 3 years old, And the boys were all playing basketball and the girls were watching. And the little girl asked her mom, why are only the boys playing? The girls aren't playing. And the mother had absolutely not noticed. And she realized how much she doesn't see of our, at that time, current culture.
Do you know what her response to the daughter was?
Well, she was more reflecting in the mother's group about the pain she wasn't even aware that she had. Mm-hmm. I don't know what she said in the moment. Mm-hmm. She was emotionally startled by her own reaction.
You have a chapter called Mother-Daughter Relationship Themes, and one of the subsets is being the same and being different. And before I ask you to give an example of that, let me read your introduction to it. You say, being identified as female is the first documented designation of a baby being the same as her mother. A mother's reactions to having a baby girl are influenced by what being female means to her and by what being female means in the family and in the larger world. Furthermore, a mother's reaction to having a daughter may be influenced by what it means to the mother that her baby is the same sex as she is. With and without the mother's awareness, being the same sex can have a profound impact on their interactions. For the mother, the sex of her baby may be the fulfillment of a wish, disappointment, or may elicit feelings that neutralize a prior preference. Before you read an example of this, what I would add to it, which are things I hear in the office, are, and this is mentioned throughout the book, but also what having a child of either gender, what it means to the parent in relation to their own parent. That is, do they feel they're disappointing a parent if they have a boy or a girl, and how they negotiate that disappointment, whether it be fully real or imagined, nevertheless, it lives in the minds of new parents.
Yes, very much.
And you have a wonderful example. Yeah.
All of the examples that we'll talk about today, the names are changed. Sure. And these examples all come from mother-baby-toddler groups over the years. Mm-hmm. During a mother-toddler group, Caitlin explained, I always thought I had beautiful hair. It's still my best feature. Fiona's only 2.5, but already she has beautiful, long, thick hair, just like mine. People are always admiring her hair. No one even notices my hair anymore. I can't believe I feel competitive with my own daughter. I remember when I was a teenager, my mother always complained, men used to look at me, but when we're together, they only look at you. I guess I feel the same way my mother did. Maya added, Yvette is 3 years old and also has beautiful hair, long blonde hair with natural highlights like her dad. I wish I had her hair. I have short, mousy brown, straggly hair, but it doesn't matter to Yvette. Yesterday, she told me that she does not like her hair and wants her hair to look like mine. Being the same, the pleasure in being the same. Geraldine chimed in. From the first moment I saw my baby, I knew she was completely different from me. This was good for our relationship and good for her. She didn't have any of the traits I don't like in myself.
It is so common in all of us where individuation from one's parents leans into rebellion against one's parents. And the difference is significant, of course, because rebellion always contains the conflicted wish to be like, and then they end up being like, similar to. The content may be different, but the process of relating is the same. And those types of steps are other than what we try to help people develop, which is a sense of autonomy where you enjoy your own uniquenesses and also can take pleasure in the uniquenesses of your parents, as well as noticing all of our human limitations.
And those conflicts you're describing, we also see in very, very young children. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a little while.
About body similarities and differences, you write, while family members may talk about body similarities and differences, including eye color, hair color, and right or left-handedness, and they may identify specific traits like dimples and freckles and note differences in size, they tend to talk less about their feelings about the similarities and differences. Some comparisons that trigger intense feelings may not be talked about at all. A mother's love for her daughter gradually deepens her self-reflection and insight about her reactions to all of the ways in which she is similar to and different from her daughter. Understanding how her little girl feels about the similarities and differences may be an important fact to be revealed. And that's something that often you don't hear. Helping a little girl, in this case, we're talking about little girls, how they feel about the similarities and differences. They may say, I want to be like you. Even if they have the customarily more desired attribute, they still want to be like mother because that's their world. Their world is identifying with their mother at that age.
And of course, they want to be like mother in some ways, and yet they also have conflict about it. They may not want to be like mommy and clean up her room.
Right.
So they identify with mommy and they also individuate from mommy. Mm. So, which we sometimes see in whining.
Right.
That the whining is a compromise.
We're going to get to whining a little bit because it's something that every parent knows all too well. And it's also something notably that we see in the Office of Adult Patients, where patients, actually men and women, can at times unknowingly start whining. And when it's brought to their attention, they are sort of caught short. They didn't know they were doing that, which is always a fascinating moment. And we can then learn together about what led them to adopt this very young way of relating. You have some thoughts about the mother-baby attachment and how it becomes complex. Can you read that for us?
As maturation unfolds, the attachment relationship becomes increasingly complex. We can imagine the complexity in a baby's mind. I am safe, but sometimes I get hurt. I am loved, but sometimes mommy disapproves of my behavior. I have so much to learn from mommy, but sometimes I hate learning to do what mommy wants and do what I want to do. The mother-baby attachment relationship is further complicated by a baby's autonomy strivings. Babies and toddlers have physical, cognitive, and emotional needs outside the attachment matrix. A baby's physical abilities rapidly develop. She vigorously pursues her maturational urges to roll over, sit, crawl, and walk. When her diaper is being changed, she twists and squirms to be free of constraint, while her mother wrestles to contain the overflowing poop. Pleasurable play with mommy that gratifies her attachment needs while her diaper is being changed can momentarily temper her autonomous activities. An interesting toy to explore during diaper changes can support her autonomy and at the same time engage her cooperation. For both mothers and toddlers, new pleasures and new challenges arise.
I think distracting an infant while you're changing them is one of the tricks I think that all parents and grandparents learn rather quickly and of necessity.
But I would elaborate that idea of distracting.
Yeah.
What we're doing is giving them an opportunity to explore, to express their curiosity. We're not scrambling their minds with distraction.
Point very well made. Thank you. Now, like you just said, identifying with and individuating from, you write, a little girl's developing sense of self is a synthesis of her individuating from and identifying with her mother and includes, I am a girl. Being seen as a girl starts at the beginning of a girl's life. She is told in a multitude of implicit and explicit ways that she is a girl, and she begins to self-identify as a girl. During the first 3 years, she also learns a great deal about what it means to be a girl, much of which she learns from her mother. Some of her experiences are, I am a girl, mommy is a woman. Only mommies can be pregnant and feed their babies with their breasts. When I grow up, I will be a woman. You go on to say another subset of that is under the category of pleasing oneself and pleasing others. Certainly themes in childhood and throughout life. You write, narcissism and masochism are prominent themes in our culture. To use everyday language, being self-centered and being a pushover are both criticized. Bullying others to control them for one's own satisfaction or benefit is censured. Being a sucker is criticized. However, generosity towards others, even to one's own disadvantage, is sometimes idealized and at times may be considered heroic. What is an optimal balance between pleasing oneself and pleasing others? How is that balance achieved between mother and their daughters during the first 3 years, you ask? The balance between pleasing oneself and pleasing others. Now, there's a big topic. What do you want to add to that?
I do see whining as an example of pleasing oneself, a compromise between pleasing oneself and pleasing the other. The wish to please mommy and the wish to please herself. That's and here's an example. Gretchen was 26 months old and asked for more cookies. Her mother, Sybil, said, "Gretchen, I've told you, no more cookies. Don't ask me again." Gretchen whined for more cookies. Gretchen's wish to please her mother by continuing to want and furthermore to demand another cookie conflicted with her wish to please her mother by not asking for or even wanting another cookie. Her internal conflict was revealed by her using a whining voice rather than her regular assertive voice. Her mother was also conflicted. She preferred that Gretchen not want another cookie. If Gretchen didn't want another cookie, she would not ask for one, and Sybil would not need to say no to her daughter. Sybil wanted to please her daughter. "I don't like to say no to her, but she's had enough." Sybil's internal conflict between pleasing her daughter or saying no was embedded in her statement, "Don't ask me again." Furthermore, Sybil wanted her daughter to be assertive in the world, but not assertive with her in the moment. Both Sybil's and Gretchen's internal conflicts about whom to please were being negotiated interpersonally. Sybil became aware of her own conflict and acknowledged Gretchen's. She said, "I know you really want another cookie. You are asking in your little whiny voice instead of your strong voice because I said, don't ask me again. I should not have said that. You really like these cookies. I always want to know what you like, what you want, and what you think. You can always tell me. Tomorrow, you can have another cookie."
You have thoughts about that exchange?
Yes, I think that her mother was struck with the importance of that her request of her child, "Don't ask me again," really meant don't want what you want. Mm. And mm-hmm. She recognized that in the moment, and she wanted to correct it with her little girl. Another example is Jenny and her mother. Also a conflict between pleasing oneself and pleasing the other. Jenny was 18 months old. Her cousin wanted to hug her, but Jenny did not want to be hugged, pushed him away, and ran to her mother. Family members watching this interaction were critical of Jenny for rejecting her cousin. They accused her of hurting his feelings and being just like her mother, a cold fish. Jenny's mother wanted to support Jenny and was offended by the accusations. Nevertheless, she decided it was important to support Jenny's decision to please herself and not be hugged.
That's the kind of example that I imagine if a group of mothers would listen to it, they would respond very differently. Is that your sense too?
Well, I guess it depends where the group was. In this particular group, right, there was a lot of agreement. Another relevant example was Genevieve in the group said, "One important lesson my mother taught me," and the whole group organized around this lesson, and I want to teach to my daughter is, sometimes it's okay to do something that's important to you, even if it makes someone else sad or angry. My older sister always wanted to wear my clothes. Usually it was okay with me, but for my 14th birthday, my father bought me a new purse that I loved, and my sister wanted to use it. I didn't want her to, but I never would have said no to her. My mother said, "Your purse was a special gift to you from Daddy." You don't need to let your sister use it, even if it makes her sad or angry. I often remember my mother's words, there is so much pressure on girls to be nice. I think they need to know it's okay to satisfy themselves.
You know, the last sentence you said, there's so much pressure on girls to be nice. We're going to get to the inevitable section that must be gotten to about so much pressure on girls to be pretty and how that played out in one family. It's my favorite part of the book. Let's move on to the section of becoming a mother. And you have on page 16 something to read about that.
A woman's ideas about being pregnant, giving birth, and being a mother originate in childhood. Although some aspects are universal, each girl has her own unique experience becoming a mother. The trajectory for each girl is influenced by the stories her mother tells, the birth of younger siblings, scenes from movies and scenarios in books, a woman's pregnancies, miscarriages, abortions, fertility, complications, and childbirth experience influence her path to becoming a mother. Her career and romances influence her plans for motherhood. A woman's relationship with her own mother plays a role. Her imagination fills the gaps.
I thought that was such a rich sentence. A woman's relationship with her own mother plays a role. You had mentioned previously that cultural perceptions play a role. And now you're adding a third component. Her imagination fills in the gaps. Can you say more about that?
Yes, and I like that you picked this up and asked this question about imagination. A mother's imagination is very important. Imagination includes conscious and unconscious fantasies, wishes, fears, and related feelings. Imagination is part of her empathy. She imagines what her baby feels. A mother imagines the next steps in her baby's development. For example, her baby makes a sound, and her mother imagines that her baby said mama, and the mother responds as if her baby did say mama. Delighted, her mother says, yes, I'm mama, and the baby starts to learn the word mama. And then there are other kinds of imaginations that are more related to history.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by relate to history?
Yes. Renata explained, quote, I waited as long as I could to get pregnant. I had so many fears. Growing up, my brother always hurt me. When I was 5, he broke my arm. When I was 10, he gave me a black eye. For me, girls were vulnerable and boys were dangerous. As a child, I never felt safe. I want to know the sex of my baby as soon as possible. It's easier since I'm pregnant to imagine a girl as safe and a boy as gentle. I feel stronger than I have ever felt. I don't feel as afraid as I did before I got pregnant. As a child, Renata was not protected when she needed to be. With the help of therapy, Renata's lifelong fear of her brother, which she had extended to other boys and men, and fears about being a girl, which meant being weak and vulnerable, had abated. However, her fears were reactivated in anticipation of having a baby. Nevertheless, being pregnant, she felt powerful. She explained, I must be strong. I'm creating a new life, and childbirth requires strength. My fears are memories of when I was a frightened little girl.
You move on in the book and you focus periods of time, as opposed to general themes. You go from birth to 1 year, 1 to 2, and 2 to 3. And let me read, focusing on birth to 1 year, you write, and the subtitle is, It's a Girl. After her daughter is born, a mother's thought about her baby being a girl in some moments may be vivid and other times may fade into the background. Some reactions may be surprising and rarely, if ever, talked about. And you go on to say, in many moments, a mother may barely notice or think about her baby's sex. However, when a mother views a physical or behavioral trait that her daughter has as particularly feminine, or a trait that violates her own sense of femininity, her baby's femaleness may rush to the front of her mind. Mothers may be surprised by their own male and female stereotypes that get triggered, as well as those of others. Which leads us to the inevitable blue-pink question. Let me invite you to share the example of Maxine and the blue-pink question.
Mothers, this is about Maxine, may be alarmed by attitudes about gender they never knew they had. Liz, who had attended a family Thanksgiving dinner with six-week-old Maxine, described what happened. My whole family was meeting Maxine for the first time. I was so excited. When we walked in, everyone rushed over to see her, and my cousin said, "Why do you have her dressed in a brown and beige striped onesie? We can't tell she's a girl, especially when you call her Max." I was horrified. I didn't like pink. I have no pink for her. I would never put a bow in her hair. She's too little to wear a dress. I prefer more gender-neutral clothes. I thought her nickname was cute. I never knew I had such negative feelings about many girl things. I wonder why I do. I definitely want people to know she's a girl. Liz began to identify childhood memories about her brother that motivated many of her decisions about how to dress Maxine. For example, quote, my brother had the best black jacket, but my mother would not buy one for me. She said it was only for boys. She bought me a pink one instead. I hated it. Liz began to realize that feelings she had towards her brother were influencing her attitudes towards her daughter's femininity and the decisions she was making.
That's such a wonderful example of how when you scratch the surface of cultural preferences, you discover individual childhood paths. Really demonstrates it well. That said, you and I speaking offline compared notes, and we are both aware of groups of demographically similar people, well-educated, culturally astute, who have their first or second children. And some of the people we know think it perfectly obvious to do blue for boys and pink for girls. And some of the people we know think it's perfectly obvious to do what this person did, is grays and browns and, quote, gender nonspecific. And each group can't imagine the thinking of the other group, which says something about something. But I think it's worthwhile putting it out there.
Well, I think you're suggesting that the personal decisions people make about names, dress, how they dress the children, decorate their rooms, have a lot of personal meaning, a lot of history that they bring to those decisions.
That's for sure. What is more intriguing is how infrequently those cultural decisions are held in a place where we could be curious about their individual origins. There's such a stridency that this is the culturally correct way to do it that we lose sight of the fact that, yeah, I mean, I get that. It's not hard to understand. But if you're in a setting where you can be interested in more than that, you learn stories like you just said about, well, this girl had a brother and he was preferred this way, and things become far more nuanced. And I guess that's what makes our life so interesting. A sense of self, sex, and gender for you to read on page 82.
Designating the biological sex of a baby occurs either before or at birth. But at what age a baby girl self-identifies as a girl is difficult to say. In recent years, there has been increased attention to and controversy about the meanings of gender in medicine, law, politics, and child development. Picture books for young children and marketing of toys have been influenced by shifting cultural attitudes. While in 1967, the box cover of the game Battleship showed a father and son playing the game and a mother and daughter washing dishes in the background, today this would not occur. Some of the societal changes and controversies among experts have raised questions for parents. Over 25 years ago, I conducted a written survey among the 60 mothers and fathers attending my groups with their children between 1 and 3.5 years of age to the question, does your daughter know she is a girl? And does your son know that he is a boy? All of the parents answered yes. In response to the questions, how does your daughter know she is a girl? And how does your son know that he's a boy? They filled in the blank, because I tell her, or because I tell him. However, what is left unanswered for us are the multiple ways in which parents tell their children explicitly and implicitly, deliberately and inadvertently, you are a girl and you are a boy.
And one of the ways this is communicated is in the inevitable, and this is, you have a section on this that I'm about to read, awareness of male-female genital differences, which happens in every family. You write, discovery of female-male genital differences is thought to occur at about 16 months of age. A little girl assumes that all the parts of her body are exactly the way they should be. And just as she has learned to expect that people have a head, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, as she does, she expects others to have the same genital body parts as she has. Girl-boy genital differences are not what she expects. When she discovers that a little boy does not have what she has, this violation of an expectation contributes to her interest, awareness of not like me, and the curiosity it stimulates. In addition, awareness of her pleasurable genital sensation stimulates a little girl's increasing awareness of an interest in girl-boy genital differences and contributes to self-identifying as a girl. Consider the pleasure during the first 3 years that a girl experiences being naked and the pride she takes in her naked body. Now, this is a challenging topic, and one hears it a great deal in the office. Not just from adults in their own experiences that are remnants of their childhood experiences, but also with adults who have young children, often boys and girls. And they observe how the boys and girls relate to each other's bodies, including and especially their genitals. And one of the ways this is front and center is the bathing question. It is obviously easier and more efficient to bathe two children at the same time, of whatever their genders. And yet, predictably, at a certain point, that starts provoking reactions in each of them. They're curious, they're touching, they're unsettled. Eileen, walk us through this. What have you heard from parents? What have you learned from parents? And what do they look for from you to help them manage these often challenging situations?
Well, I'd say in addition to the easy convenience of bathing two children together or three children together, there are other motivations of bathing them together. Parents are less aware of that there is an excitement in seeing the children naked. And so the other things go into the decision, although convenience is what's stated first, I think other things do go into it. And you make an important point that through development, reactions to the genital difference and nudity will change. And I believe that those being aware of those changes is very useful for parents to make decisions about what they want to do in their family about family nudity. Toileting, bathing, running around naked. So it's looking at those changes. I have a striking, memorable example that came up in a mother's group about the arousal of children to nudity, to body sensation. Beatrix told us in the mother's group about a nighttime ritual of gently fingertip tickling her daughter's arm, back, and tummy before sleep, as she had been tickled when she was a little girl and fondly remembered. One night, pointing to her genitals, her two-year-old daughter said, "Mommy, tickle me there." Beatrix was startled She had not remembered or realized that the tickling had been arousing in that way. During the present moment, like when children are bathing, while tickling her daughter, a reliving of the past had replaced remembering. However, her daughter's awareness of pleasurable genital sensation was clear. And the same thing applies to bathing.
It's a great story. We need to move on from that, but it's not moving very far, because the next section, you have reactivated childhood sexual guilt. Let me invite you to read that section.
Many things influence mothers' reactions to their toddlers' sexually related behavior. As an adult, Kathleen knew that childhood genital exploration and touching for pleasure were considered normal, but her own childhood memories of shame and guilt were activated when 16-month-old Amber started to masturbate. Quote, "I'm afraid she's going to hurt herself," which is often an interesting reaction parents have, the fear of hurting oneself, and what that means when that fear is triggered is of interest usually. "I think it's normal, but I'm worried. I was not allowed to do that." When Amber developed some genital irritation and the pediatrician wanted to catheterize her to make a diagnosis, Kathleen was unable to tell her that she thought the irritation was from masturbation, not from an infection. "I felt too embarrassed and guilty to tell the doctor." The terror and pain that Amber experienced being catheterized and the fact that she did not have a urinary tract infection amplified Kathleen's guilt. Quote, "It's all my fault. If I had told the doctor, she would not have needed to be catheterized." Another example of childhood sexual guilt is related to nose picking. It's another thing many children do. During a mother's group discussion about their little girl's beginning genital exploration and touching for pleasure, Autumn had a shameful memory that she related to childhood sexual guilt. "Jaden has started to pick her nose." This is her quote. "Jaden has started to pick her nose. She's only 23 months, but she really likes to do it. I'm so embarrassed when she does it in public. I think it's disgusting. Every time she does it, I have a flashback. When I was a child, I picked my nose in bed and reached my finger with the mucus on it below the side of my bed and rubbed it on the wall. No one could see it. It was under the bed. And I never did it in public. But when I was 11 years old and we were moving, the moving men came into my bedroom to pack my bed. As they moved my bed away from the wall, all the mucus that I had rubbed on the wall showed. I was so embarrassed. I think my memory is really about childhood masturbation. I don't actually remember picking my nose or masturbating as a child. I only remember the shame I felt when the wall was exposed and all was dirty."
That's such a ubiquitous phenomena of the childhood's masturbatory shame and guilt being revealed. And this is in boys when they have wet dreams or they have tissues, and girls, like in the example you're describing, it's almost a universal part of childhood. We hear it a great deal, you know, on the couch from adults as well. We unfortunately have to move along a little quickly because, and there are other things that are important to get to in the book. You have conflicts between work and family, certainly ubiquitous in all of our lives. You have a story about 20-month-old Burgundy. You can share that.
Okay. In the mother's words, in Corinda's words, "I leave work to see Burgundy during the day, which isn't good for my work. And then she screams when I leave her to go back to work. My mom was always the perfect mother, but she never did anything else with her life. I was always determined that when I grew up, I would take care of my children and have a career. My mother only took care of my father, me, and my siblings. I remember the smell of freshly baked cookies every day when I came home after school. They were perfect. Now, on my way home from work, I stop in the bakery for cookies to bring home to Burgundy. But store-bought is not the same as home-baked, and it makes me get home too late. Sometimes she's already asleep. I want to have a career, and I want to be with Burgundy. A woman without a career is nothing. So Corinda goes on to really have a remarkable insight. She recognizes, she says, maybe if I didn't devalue my mother so much for not working, I wouldn't have to idealize her so much as a mother. And this big split that she had done between her idealization and devaluation really interfered with her integrating work and care of her daughter until she had this insight and made a few big changes.
Her characterization of cookies aren't cookies. There's homemade and store-bought. And there are, you can almost smell the aroma of the differences as she's describing them. We're jumping ahead to 2 to 3 years now. And the reader should know that we are just selecting little gems from the book. There's much more to be had in a full reading. And the story of being a girly girl. Why don't you pick that up? That's on page 143.
Cultural shifts and mother-daughter relationship themes intertwine. Carla described herself as a woman who rejected female gender stereotypes and found her 3-year-old daughter's exclusive choice of sparkling party dresses disturbing. I do not want Mila to be a girly girl. She only wants to wear her party shoes and dresses, even to the playground. For Halloween, she only wants to wear a princess costume. A pilot or a doctor would be out of the question. We fight all the time about what she wears and what she plays with. She got a Barbie for her birthday, and that's all she plays with now. She even wants to wear bikini lace panties like her friend. She's only 3. Suddenly, Carla remembered that when she was a little girl, her mother had wanted her to wear bikini panties, bows in her hair, and uncomfortable dresses with tights. Quote, my mother always wanted me to be a different kind of girl than I wanted to be. She still does. She always says things like, get a hairstyle, wear some makeup. You still look like a ragamuffin tomboy. The other day we went shopping and she criticized my underwear. I don't wear bikini underpants. I can't believe it. I'm almost 40 and she's still trying to dress me. I'm doing a different version of the same thing with Mila that my mother does with me. I'm trying to get her to be more like me. She's the kind of girl my mother wanted me to be. With her new awareness of the connections between her childhood memories and current interactions with her mother and daughter, Carla was able to allow her daughter to be the kind of girl she wanted to be, which was different than the kind her mother wanted to be. Carla was able to recognize the activation of mother-daughter relationship themes that contributed to their angry interactions. Carla now believed that their fights about lace panties had more to do with Mila's autonomy, strivings, being different from her mother and the same as her friends. For Mila, lace panties had nothing to do with men and sex.
And that's really the take home. It's so easy to take the superficial gloss on it that it's a hypersexual, heterosexual thing. But as you so beautifully point out, it's really about being similar to and different from her mother. And in this case, similar to and different from her grandmother.
Right.
I have a favorite exchange in the book. Forgive me my choice of my choosing favorite things. I'm just drawn to that. And it's about the issue of a 3-year-old being considered pretty. I have you reading that. Why don't you pick us up on page 144, Candace?
Quote, this is Candace. Looking pretty is another intertwined cultural and personal theme. Candace, her mother and father were all going to a party wearing a new dress, sparkling shoes, and a beret that glittered. Candace asked her mother, Lori, do I look pretty? Her mother was disturbed by the question and angry at the world that her not-yet-three-year-old daughter was concerned about looking pretty. Quote, there's so much pressure on girls and women to be pretty. Boys don't, this is Candace in the mother's group, boys don't worry about being pretty or being handsome. The only time in my life that I didn't worry about being pretty was when I was pregnant. I just felt pretty. Lori wondered what it meant to Candace to be pretty. She also wondered if there was any significance to the exact words of her daughter's question, do I look pretty? Candace did not ask, am I pretty? This distinction was important to Lori. She explained, the question that Candace asked, do I look pretty, may mean that to her, pretty is a description of the item she's wearing, not an evaluation of her innate physical traits. In contrast, the question, am I pretty, would refer to an assessment of her. This way of thinking about Candace's question makes me feel better and gives me a chance to influence how she thinks about being pretty. The women in the group all thought the distinction was useful.
You know, I thought this was such a unique way of thinking about it. Said a different way, the concern about the cultural imperative about how you appear, whether you appear, how you appear to other females, girls or women or males, is, needless to say, valid and central. But we can be so attentive to the cultural pressures and our wishes to avoid them, resist them, that we stop listening carefully. And I think this is such a beautiful example of listening carefully. Aside from what we think it may mean, what might it mean to the three-year-old? And this distinction of, do I look pretty, seems, and we don't know her associations, as it were, we don't know exactly what she means, but it certainly lends itself to think that, yes, she's saying, do you like this dress? Do you like these shoes? Do you like how they match? Do you like how they fit? Which is an entirely different curiosity and vulnerability than, am I pretty? Is my heart and soul, my body, is it attractive? And I think inviting us to be sensitive to that distinction is worth the price of the book, if I must say so, Eileen. It really sharpens our focus to not think too quickly or to not think too much of our own pressures in our mind and to really listen to what everybody, but in this case, little girls are telling us about things that are important to them. So I want to thank you for bringing that.
And it goes back to your highlighting the idea of imagination and to imagine the things it could mean, all the things her question could mean.
As opposed to what we think it does mean because that's what we read in the newspaper that day kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. You wanted to mention something important about the fear of sexual abuse. So let me turn that over to you for that.
For one mom, the fear of sexual abuse, of her daughter being sexually abused, all of a sudden emerged for her. And she started instructing her 2.5-year-old little girl how to protect herself. Don't talk to strangers. Don't get in a car. All kinds of frightening warnings about what could happen rather than becoming attentive to protecting her child. And this approach for her had referred back to her own childhood where she was unprotected, but not only unprotected from her brother taunting her, spying on her in the bathroom, but she was also accused of liking it, that her own sexual excitement as a child was being ridiculed. And that history, when she read an article in the newspaper about a little girl getting sexually abused, heightened all of her fear about her own daughter. And as she made that connection between the unconscious meaning of her fear for her daughter, she became more protective of her daughter. I think that's the story you're referring to.
How useful it is to become aware of the unconscious meaning of these external events. You make that point throughout all your works, certainly in this book. And on that note, you have a very clear closing paragraph to the book, and let me invite you to read that.
It is my hope that this book awakens childhood memories and increases awareness about the ways in which a mother's own experiences being a little girl, the personal and the cultural, influence mother-daughter interactions. It is a further goal to recognize the ways in which a mother's interactions with her daughter from birth to 3 years contribute to a mother's expanding sense of self and enrich a woman's own life. While I was writing Mothers and Daughters, I spoke to my children and grandchildren about my ideas and got many comments for them. When my granddaughters read part of the finished book aloud with me, like we were reading, I asked them whether the book is what they expected from our conversations while I was writing it. One of them said, and they all agreed, yes, it's what I expected, but it really comes alive. That moment meant everything to me.
I bet. And I hope that vibrancy of the book comes across in our conversation. Again, we've just chosen a few brief excerpts. There's much more in it. And all I could say is any mother of a new or toddler baby girl would do well to read this book. You will feel you are among other mothers, which is itself very valuable. You have pointed out in your other work how important friend mothers are to negotiating the paths of and the struggles and confusions and uncertainties of motherhood. And they will have this book with them, Eileen, as a guide, and with you sitting on their shoulder, asking them to think twice, think deeply, think about yourself, think about what's happening inside you as you engage with your daughter or daughters. So once again, Eileen, I am grateful, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you and learn from you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.